For ZDNet, this is Dan Farber. You're listening to a podcast of the 2007 MIT CIO Symposium held on May 17th, 2007. First, a word from our sponsor. This is the fourth annual summit presented by the MIT Sloan Alumni Club of Boston, the MIT Center for Digital Business, and the Society for Information Management. This year's theme was Networks for Competitive Advantage, People, Partners, and Processes. Here's the panel on trends in enterprise IT infrastructure, enabling the agile enterprise.
Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the MIT CIO Symposium, I welcome you to this panel, Trends in Enterprise IT Infrastructure, Enabling the Agile Enterprise. Web 2.0, virtualization, SOA, on-demand are all compelling visions promoted by the major IT vendors. They paint a picture of a world where IT enables the agile enterprise. Business strategies can be adapted in real time, and IT can be offered as a service. Service levels are guaranteed, and resources can be provisioned just in time. This session will separate fact from fiction, identify what works and what doesn't, and highlight what IT organizations should do. Let me introduce our moderator, Marianne Johnson. Mary Fran, is the president and I told you I could spell it, but I didn't say I could say it, right? That's right. Mary Fran is an award-winning IT journalist and well-known industry editor who now runs her own company, specializing in executive events and CIO roundtables. So let me turn it over to Mary Fran.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much. Thank you. As Jeff mentioned, we are indeed here today to talk about key trends in enterprise IT infrastructure. And I think you will really enjoy the panel discussion here because I've got a very feisty bunch of hype busters up here. Every time we got going on some of these various buzzwords, it was all I could do to keep people from throwing a punch. So I've encouraged everyone to be very active and to disagree with each other and by all means to argue with the audience. So I expect this, if nothing else, we'll keep ourselves warm during this discussion here today. I'm going to very quickly introduce the panelists and then we're going to just leap right into our questions. Sitting directly to my left is Frank Infanto. Frank is the Vice President of Healthcare Services Systems Delivery for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, the state's largest health insurer with 2.8 million customers. Frank is responsible for development and IT strategic direction for all the web healthcare provider services, case management, wellness systems, and applications. He's also served as VP of Operations Delivery and Information Security at Blue Cross with responsibility for all systems and network operations. So when we talk about infrastructure, this is a guy who knows his infrastructure. Frank has more than 20 years of IT experience, has participated as a speaker at various industry events. In fact, I've had the pleasure to introduce and be on stage with Frank many times before. And he is prone to starting fights on panels, so this is it's great to have him here. Prior to joining Blue Cross, Frank held executive IT positions at Cambridge Soundworks, HiFi.com, Lightbridge Inc., NewsEdge, and Wang Laboratories. Sitting right next to Frank is another one of his CIO partners in crime. Mary Finley is the deputy CIO of Partners Healthcare System. This is the region's largest integrated healthcare system encompassing 10 prominent hospitals in eastern Massachusetts, such as Brigham and Women's, Mass General, Newton Wellesley, and McLean. Mary is charged with the daily management of an organization of some 1,300 IT and telecommunications staff, and she takes care of a 56,000 node network with more than 1,000 servers and 800 applications on it. So again, we have another expert IT practitioner who deals with a lot of infrastructure issues. Before joining Partners, Mary was the CIO at Brigham and Women's, and before that, a senior systems consultant with automatic data processing. She has consistently won awards for her outstanding contributions to IT leadership and frequently makes CIO Magazine's list of the top CIOs to watch. I know I like to keep my eye on her, so we will definitely be doing that. Next to Mary is Alex Rodriguez. Alex is the director of the Managed Services Group for Expedient Communications, which operates America's largest all-Ethernet network and hosts more than 4,000 servers at 8 data centers on the East Coast alone. They are headquartered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and have been around since 2001. Alex provides strategic direction, operational management, and service delivery for all managed services in Expedient's portfolio of data centers. He brings with him more than 10 years of experience in the service provider arena and previously held senior positions at several nationally recognized ISPs and telecommunications companies. Then further on down on our very distinguished panel, our fourth panelist is Rich Corley. He is the founder and CEO of Acori, which is the newest company we have on our panel. It's based in Littleton, Mass., and was founded in January of 2005. And Acori specializes in performance optimization software for data center applications. As the CEO, Rich is responsible for strategic direction and general management. He brings also a lot of technical background to the table as well, with more than 20 years of software engineering experience. Before founding Acori, he was the founder and executive vice president at Purus Networks, which was acquired by Sun Microsystems in 2002. And before that, he was a director of advanced technology at Nortel. Earlier in his career, Rich held founding and engineering management positions at a whole lineup of companies, Aptus, Aris, Chipcon, Data General, and Concord Data Systems. And then finally, last but certainly not least, is John Williams. He is a professor of information engineering, civil and environmental engineering, and engineering systems. Lest we not figure it out, he knows a lot about engineering here at MIT. And he's also director of the Auto ID Laboratory. And when you hear him say it in his lovely British accent, it will sound a lot classier. His area of specialty is large-scale computer analysis applied to both physical systems and information. John teaches graduate courses on modern software development and on web system architecting, and he's internationally recognized in the field of computational algorithms for large-scale particle simulators. For the last 8 years, he's been focusing his research on architecting large-scale distributed simulation systems. Now, as director of MIT's Auto ID Laboratory, John is also one of the leaders in the effort to bring us the Internet of Things. He is a project leader also in the Grid Agent Computing Program, whose goal is to develop distributed systems that simulate the U.S. critical infrastructure. And if all that were not enough to have on his plate, he's also involved in a number of industry projects working directly with companies such as Microsoft and RFID sensor networks for Kojima Corporation. So, now that I've introduced my thoroughly frightening panel of experts up here, let me try and throw out our first question. You heard the description from Jeff about how we're going to talk on keys about the enabling the enterprise infrastructure and the agile enterprise and how CIOs, basically what CIOs should be paying the most attention to out on this frontier right now. This world of business strategies that can be adapted in real time is a great vision that we do hear a lot about, but it is not the real world for most people. Certainly, it wouldn't be the real world for you'll hear from Frank and Mary. So we're here, hopefully, to separate this fact from fiction. And I'm going to start out with a question for the group on the agile enterprise itself. When I look at the term as someone who's been in IT journalism for a long time, it sounds a little bit to me like a marketing slogan, or I imagine an enterprise all dressed up in a tutu and leaping around on the stage. You know, all of a sudden everybody's all agile. So what does an agile enterprise actually look like? When I talk with people, I often say, I need concrete examples. You know, show me what that means. Tell me what it's about. And I'm going to start by picking on Frank, since he's the closest to me here. Frank, when we talked about agile enterprise, you said it's an approach. Someone will try to sell you agile, but you're not sure that it can really be sold. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, if you try to describe, as you said earlier, picturize what the agile enterprise is, I don't think you can find out, because each one of us would look at it as something a little bit different from an enterprise perspective. So I really think it's an approach of how you go from layer to layer across your enterprise. So remember, the infrastructure consists of your hardware, your software, your middleware, storage. You have all of these pieces. And if you try to make that entire thing agile, it's more than just putting sneakers on all of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's you take each one of those as an approach and say, what is that in that layer? What is it going to allow me to be agile within that layer? Let's just take a quick example. From a hardware perspective, if you have a series of web applications and they're all very siloed vertical applications that are in environments amongst themselves, the next time you add one, you're going to have to add another vertical. However, if that same set of applications were built upon horizontal layers where you used all of it across, the next time you put in an application, all you need to worry about is the added capacity on any one of those particular layers. To me, that's agile, but that's an approach to a specific thing. But as you take each one of the pieces in your architecture and you approach it that way, eventually the whole becomes somewhat agile. So I really think agility is more or less found in each one of the pieces and layers of your architecture.
Okay, fair enough. That's a very practical. One of the things you noted about it was that it's not always possible to turn a vertical architecture to horizontal unless you have all the pieces coordinated. So governance plays into this?
Right. I mean, most of us, I think, as the years, you know, if you take companies over the last 5, 6, 7 years have built these applications, now all of a sudden we want to do something a little bit different. You can't just jump from one to the other. I mean, I'm not sure about anyone else, but you could never go into a budgeting process and say, I need some money to create the agile enterprise. I mean, it's not going to work that way. So I think what you almost need to do is you need to say, okay, I'm in this situation. If I had to build this over again, what would it look like? Okay, so now you've got where you are and where you would like to be. And again, I think as Charlie said earlier today in his, it's almost a modernization type of thing. It's something you do in pieces as you go along. So you try to build some sort of a roadmap based upon the projects that you have to do and see if you can do that transformation. And again, it's not just a change in it's not a technology. This is not all a technology issue. It's a funding issue. It's moving from one to the other. And it becomes a cultural issue because you have organizations which will say, you can't do that. That's my system. My hardware, my software, that's my system. How can you combine it with something else? Well, in reality, you know, it's really a resource. And if people can change and start to look at everything as a resource, you can make that movement from vertical to horizontal. You know, so, it comes down to governance and it comes down to culture as well.
Okay. And Rich, I see you nodding sagely over there. Tell me what you see from Acori's customers. When do you go out and throw around words with them like agile, or do you hear it from them?
We hear a lot of it from our customers. You know, one of the big trends today, one of the big buzzwords is virtualization. And you're starting to see virtualization appear at the server layer. You know, obviously a company like VMware is taking off like wildfire. And folks are very anxious to try it out. And how does that enable them now to be agile? And really what VMware does, what server virtualization does in general, is turn a resource into a service. It takes a server now and turns it into a compute service. And then how do you manage that compute service? That's the struggle that enterprises are dealing with today. And networks have been virtualized for decades. Storage devices have been virtualized for decades. So how do you take these components, these hardware resources, put them into a service, and then control that service, manage that service?
Okay. Now, John, in the world that you straddle, both academic and the industry world, when you hear terms like this, when you hear agile enterprise, when people start talking about virtualization, put on your professor hat for a minute and tell us what these words really mean.
Yeah, I'm worried about what they mean. I think there's a lot of vaporware around these days. Let me tell you what I think is going on. I mean, to date, we've had applications within our four walls, and they're kind of fairly easy to control. That we understand what the roles are within those. We can do security fairly well. As soon as we go outside the enterprise and try to do anything cross-enterprise, so, you know, if you're trying to use somebody else's service across the web, these issues of security, identity management become very, very serious issues. We're trying to deal with supply chains, with products in the supply chain. So these products are coming from China, going through customs, going across the different countries, and we have to deal with very different systems, very different security architectures, and what we're finding is things like identity become serious issues. That you think that identity is, who I am, so I'm John Williams. But as far as an application goes, or let's suppose I'm coming up to customs, I have to present a certain security credential to them. And it's not that I'm just John Williams. I have to present a passport. Whereas if I'm stopped by a policeman, he wants my driving license, a different security credential. So, you know, if we're going to buy gas, where's the credit card? Another security credential. So once you go outside the enterprise, these security credentials are not well defined. And we're finding real problems. So the issues that we're seeing, security is the base one. It's a major one that people are talking about meta-identity systems now. Mm-hmm. There's this work, Microsoft, IBM, work, and Sun are working on that. Scalability, I think, is when you're talking about of increasing, you know, I've got applications, I suddenly need to scale up. How mm-hmm. do I do that? VMware obviously addresses some of that. But you have to think about that when you're architecting these things. And extensibility, you're going to change your interfaces over time. Web services is not the, is not, you know, it doesn't make it easy. If I change my interface, stuff still breaks. So people are beginning to, I'd say, go for looser coupling with applications, that you build these services. They're not tightly coupled. They're fairly loosely coupled. If you look at this movement towards REST-based interfaces, this is representational state change that just basically using URLs that can represent a query into a database, say, or pull out certain data. Amazon is using this, and they present both a web service interface and a REST-based interface. 80% of the use is on the REST-based interface. So I think this question of how loosely do you couple and how tightly do you couple, you know, your SOA architecture is critical.
Okay. Now, Alex, when we, from Expedient's point of view, and you're in charge of the, your company does a lot of managed services with a lot of outsourcing to data centers. For your customers, agility usually involves having someone else take care of a piece of their architecture, but is it more than that?
It's a little bit more than that. What we're continuing to see is our clients are coming to us. Their IT organizations are encumbered upon an ever-expanding role and responsibility set. So what we're seeing making an agile enterprise is those companies that are willing to go through and forego some of the infrastructure pieces, and that's really where we take a key component to, so that way they can focus their technical resources on the specific business focus, allowing those infrastructure needs to be met by other companies and outsourcers. And that's where we really see a big play in terms of agile enterprises, ones that can most effectively use their resources towards their specific business needs.
Okay. And then back into the healthcare world for a second. Mary, when you and I talked about this, for you, Agile Enterprise called up keeping pace with business changes and not really looking into infrastructure changes that take significant cost and energy of the resources. Talk about that a little bit.
So when I think of agile infrastructure, it really does come down to the two questions. How quickly can you introduce changes into your environment and at what cost? And I think oftentimes, again, we focus. And so when somebody comes and says, are you interested in agile infrastructure? Well, of course, because those are two very basic questions. And it's what we all struggle with when the reality is most of us, 75 to 80% of our budget is focused on keeping lights on and how quickly you introduce the changes in that environment. The real challenge is that there, technology is just one part of it. And when the technology is ready, then there's two other questions that have to be answered. One is, what does it mean internal to the IS organization to manage with this new level of technology? And the second, what does it mean outside of the organization and what needs to change? So, for instance, we could be a lot more agile if there was a business rule that said everybody did X the exact same way. Or everybody couldn't go off and purchase their own systems, departmental systems. But the reality is that's not how the world works. So we are in an environment with multiple systems and multiple platforms, and then you get back to the level of complexity.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the two technologies that kept surfacing as I talked with everyone on the panel about our topic were virtualization and the service-oriented architecture, or SOA. And both Mary and Frank, you have work underway in SOA areas right now. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, what kind of practical realities are you running into as you move toward building applications in this way?
Sure. So our challenge right now is with 10 hospitals, we have 10 sets of systems, which is really reflecting of our overall organization and governance structure. And now we are faced with how do we ensure that key information and also logic that's embedded in those clinical systems is standard across the enterprise. And we went through a process of looking at, do we change all of those 10 systems and go to a single common set of systems? Very complicated, very expensive. It also means not only just standardizing on data and logic, but also workflow. And when we focused on that, we're not ready as an organization to say that how you provide clinical care at this hospital and how nurses work is exactly the same as this hospital as well. So our strategy is to focus on building out a core set of clinical services so that, for instance, when you go to a physician now and he or she collects your problem list, your chronic diseases, your chronic challenges, that is now available regardless of which hospital you're seen at and available within those multiple different systems. Again, I think the technology is ready. Now what we're focused on is what does it mean to support a set of services? We know how to support applications, but what does it mean to actually organize around supporting services? What does it mean to be able to monitor, to scale that to a level that we've seen on the application side? And then the whole issue of governance and making sure that we've got the right people that are prioritizing what services we build out, are prioritizing when they get changed and how they get changed, and really creating that linkage with the business side. Mm-hmm.
And Frank, you said you were trying a few things, picking some spots like in your web portal application work.
Right.
Where you're utilizing.
So I think what we try to look at, you know, as we go into this area is where does it make sense for us to do this as opposed to rewriting anything or trying to convince people? Because I think if you go through and you look at SOAR and you you try to do it in a big bang approach, you put it all together at once, I mean, you spend a lot of time just on the governance alone, and you don't know, while there's best practices out there, you don't know whether it will fit in your environment or not. So what we're doing is we're looking at the applications in our portfolio and saying, does it make sense to write some of these applications with services? And, you know, for example, if we're building a member portal, we'll start to write services. And I think some mistakes that people make, they make everything a service. And that doesn't make sense. I mean, you make things at a service that are core to your business, something that could be used by another application, something that you can expose to an outside vendor, and so on. So we took those set of services and tried to do that. Same thing, a good example for us, I mean, if we're getting claims, okay, so someone wants to go out and pull claims in, well, hospitals need to pull claims in to see certain things. Doctors may need to do that. Billing agencies may need to do that. Employees may need to do that, as well as members. So, you know, why write five different applications with five different pieces of code so we create some get claim service? Same thing with enrollment. Now, while we might have four or five different types of enrollment for different products and different services, there's a core piece of enrollment there that happens with all of them. So that gets written as a service. So you try to take those pieces that actually make sense, do them initially, and then go through the whole piece. And I think the one that Mary brought up that's very important that wasn't really discussed that much in the last panel is the governance piece. If you do not have the governance piece in doing this, it does not work because, again, the gentleman from Monster said, mine's a little different. You know, my service is a little different. Well, if it's a little different, it's different. You know, so it's another service. Okay, so, I mean, if you know, so you have to have the governance around it. And the one thing was funny is someone brought up, and we didn't even realize that we had been doing this right along with our middleware. Because we were writing, we have a bunch of CBeyond messages that go back to the mainframe that pull information. And it got to the point, and it's funny, because right now you can't build a CBeyond message unless you go to one of these two people, and these two people say it's okay. But they didn't even realize they basically had set up a governance process because people were creating messages back to the mainframe, application after application, and it wasn't necessary. It already had been done somewhere else. So we had already had something in place, so we look at that as a model and say, okay, well, we kind of do it now. Can we expand that into other areas? You know, so I think there's a lot of different pieces to doing it. And if you can get some wins quickly, I think that's where to approach it.
Well, it sounds like, too, that a lot of IT organizations run into essentially ad hoc governance, things developing where you've got two guys governing a particular business role and then things build around that. That is always one of the things that seems to inform any conversation you have about technology is the incredible impact that people have on it. Maybe thank God for small favors that we're still required to be part of the technology infrastructure. Rich, one of the things when we were talking about this, and you had mentioned VMware and you know the virtualization, and you pointed out that we've got the technology virtualization is at server levels, at storage levels, it's already in the network layers, and that all plays a role in making a company more agile, more quick to do business, but that the next step was how you collaborate on the business. Aren't we then into a realm where technology really can't help you anymore?
That's absolutely right. You know, the technology does it. I agree with Frank. Technology exists. You know, it's there today. The real problem really is business process and collaboration between the business and the IT infrastructure. You know, it's amazing in my business, I go out and talk to infrastructure people all the time, and even within the different layers, the server guy and the storage guy, they hate each other, and they don't talk the same language. They're always pointing fingers at one another, and so how do you get beyond that? That's a cultural thing. Eventually, all this has to collapse. The infrastructure has to collapse into an infrastructure that's really controlled by a similar set of people that talk the same language. You know, we talk a lot in the Web 2.0 world about folksonomies. Well, you got to generate that folksonomy. What's good for you? And it is business by business. You can't come out with a product or a set of rules that's going to apply across every enterprise. It's, you know, how does the enterprise create its own processes, its own language, and be able to propagate that? Really, in reality, you know, you hear a lot about social networks and places like MySpace is creating communities. Well, we have to take those type of technologies and adopt them internally in organizations and create a community inside these organizations to create that common language.
Okay. Well, Alex, you made a point about virtualization that a lot of what you're seeing from your customers in the data centers is that the first thing they look at virtualization is as a way to cut costs. Mm-hmm. And that can often be a great way to introduce technology into an organization. You know, when you can tell the CEO this is going to save us 30% or whatever. But talk a little bit about where you're seeing virtualization play the biggest role.
Well, we're seeing virtualization play a big role in taking over the infrastructure that is just becoming, you know, a very, very huge draw on the focus and the resources from the CIOs of the businesses that we work in. In enabling a virtualized model, the CIOs can take care of a huge degree of servers and infrastructure, move them onto a new common platform that's all managed and maintained. So that way, again, they're relieving their individual technicians and personnel to go and focus on the bigger needs from the business side. That's something that we see time and time again. And that ROI, you know, speaking about the culture, that ROI is something where it can be dictated top down to show and prove out the need for change and to kind of institute that from a top approach down.
Mm-hmm. And John, you had mentioned that companies are really living and dying these days on the fact that the world is changing so quickly and how quickly software moves around, the fact that there's no more two-year cycle times for making software. From the industry work that you've done and the kind of problems that you've seen that this rolls out for the companies that are trying to provide software, what's your perspective there?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously depends what industry you're in. If you're in the military, maybe you can afford 2 years or more. but certainly in the business world, if you're a solution provider, you certainly have to be pretty quick getting the products out. And I think you see that with a lot of companies now that they'll roll out products they know they've got, maybe lacking some functionality, they'll put it out there, and the second revision will have more, you know, will have that functionality maybe. I think, one of the key problems we're seeing with using web services or services is this next layer up. What's in this next layer that provides coordination between these services? That these services need to understand and have common maybe roles. It depends how you build your services. I think Frank was very smart in saying, you know, you need to get some experience first with the low-hanging fruit. These services are not a panacea for anything. You've still got the old problems of, you know, how do I build software that I can maintain and will last? But I think we're seeing progress in the next layer up now, the kind of middleware that coordinates web services. One of the things we've seen is that web services were slow. They were brutally slow. So if you wanted to drive something that was real time in, say, a factory, that had response times of hundredths of a second, you wouldn't be doing web services. What's changed now is they've got quite fast now. We're seeing with on a machine, we can make about 90,000 web service calls a second. Across machines, about 9,000, something like that. So we're getting quite quick. The old web services of 2 or 3 years ago are not the web services you're seeing now. So that you've got binary serializers, things like that. There was some dumb stuff being done in web services a few years ago. But I think what is interesting is what's in this bus, this next layer up that can coordinate these services. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing companies are doing quite a bit of work on that. IBM, Microsoft, Sun. Okay. We're seeing some nice products up there.
What are some of the dumb things that were done with web services? Name names.
Well, we've done some really dumb things with web services.
Such as?
Well, no, I'll just give you an example. That we were providing online labs at MIT, that we were doing something that was a great project called iLabs. The idea is that you put labs online and that you can use them remotely, that an electronics lab can be... You have a chip that can be tested, and you set up your test over the web, and the results are delivered back over the web. So we wanted to make this available to... We've got a very poor kind of university down the road called Harvard that doesn't have the resources, so we wanted to provide them some labs.
Now, we try not to make fun of those people.
I know. Sorry. But we were seriously trying to provide these labs to them, and then we realized that... Obviously, Harvard knew its students and faculty would have to put them into a role, that they'd say, yes, this is an instructor, and would give permission to our labs here at MIT. And then we found out that one of the labs that was online was a nuclear facility. We have a nuclear power plant here. And then we found out some of the students in Harvard were Bin Laden's relatives. And suddenly we realized that it gets, security becomes very, very serious.
Boy, when you guys screw something up, you really do it really well.
Yeah, so we did some dumb things.
Rich, one of the things that I don't know if you got to now, you got to outdo that anecdote.
Yeah,
we had talked about IT organizations, and we're always interested in telling people, what should I be doing now? There's like a million technologies vying for the time of CIOs, and what kind of advice could we give to the practitioners and the CIOs in the audience about if you are looking at trying to make your infrastructure more responsive to the business? We'll abandon the term agile for a little while here and give that a rest and just talk about responsiveness. What are some of the things you had mentioned, embracing some Web 2.0 technologies? And talk a little bit about what you meant by that.
Well, even my own organization, and what's amazing about some of these technologies is there is a generation gap. People who are my age, don't really go out and embrace these technologies quite as quickly as, let's say, 20-year-olds that are in college and universities now. But it's amazing what can happen in an organization when you do adopt something like a wiki. That's one of the things we started embracing where I work, to really get a lot of collaboration and communication going between in the engineering organization. And what's amazing is to see how quickly folks start contributing to that and start using it. And before you know it, it becomes a daily portal for their life. And I think that's one important thing. The other important thing is, as you're looking at these technologies, is talk to other organizations. Talk to organizations that have tried it before. And if you're going to stick your toe in the puddle of virtualization, go talk to somebody who's maybe had the issues before, tried it out. Mm-hmm. You'll learn a lot of lessons. Virtualization isn't a panacea. It's not going to solve all your issues. As a matter of fact, it's going to create issues for you because virtualization hides the physical from you. And what it ends up doing is you end up getting lots of shared resources potentially being overutilized, and we see that a lot of that happening in the data centers today. Hey, I virtualized my storage layer, and now you've got 15 applications hitting the same disk sets. And you don't even see it. You don't even know what's going on.
Well, didn't we talk a little bit, too, about the potential that if you've got more and more shared services, and if IT is ultimately in control of that, a lot of the, instead of being more collaborative with the business, the control starts to shift back again into the IT organization.
Absolutely.
To the glass house days kind of
right,
feeling
right.
Where the IT guys are in control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, absolutely that happens.
And we're saying that's a bad thing.
And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but how do you, I think it's going to require you to have much more collaboration with what's going on in the business layer.
Mm-hmm.
the IT folks now really have to be aligned with what's happening at the business. And before it was these guys are in the basement, they're in control of their own domain, and it was pretty benign to the rest of the organization, but now it's not. Now it's, if you don't deliver the service properly, you could be losing millions of dollars because you don't have a infrastructure that can support the transaction rate. Mm-hmm. And issues like that.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was watching the movie Jurassic Park years ago, it was not lost on me that the one who caused all the trouble was the IT guy. He was the one who let the dinosaurs out. Now, another common thread in my conversations with all of you was this issue of dealing with, data management, but not just data management, but the rising tide of data that is starting to come in from all the sensors, all of the ways to gather data out in the world. Mary, you mentioned that this is a major area of focus for you, especially a convergence of medical devices in your IT network. Talk about some of the complexities that brings up in the fun world of running a healthcare organization.
So by medical devices, I mean a device that is attached to a patient and is collecting information, is monitoring, and typically that has been run by our biomedical engineers on a separate network with separate standards. And just more probably in the last 2 years, really as an industry focus, looking at how we can converge both from an organizational and the systems perspective, but create some real significant challenges. And you can imagine the importance of it so that you can converge that data along with other patient information that you have. But again, recognizing that typically on separate networks, and so when you think about, we currently do a 4-hour monthly downtime for system maintenance. Well, you can't take down medical devices for 4 hours, so obviously that's a challenge. When you introduce changes to these devices, it needs to be approved by the FDA. That's very different than the rest of the IT organization. But that is, again, I think an industry focus that we'll solve over the next couple of years.
Okay. Now, Frank, your organization is set up very differently. Mary does almost everything in-house, and you have a pretty significant relationship with EDS running some of your data centers. Does that issue play out in a similar way for you as well as a healthcare organization?
Well, it's not quite the same as with Mary's, but, mm-hmm. EDS does a lot from a facilities management standpoint for us with our systems and so on, but we retain the management of that. So mm-hmm. I think, from that perspective, EDS really is part of our employee base in managing the data. But again, we have the same problems that everyone else has when you look at it, and then some extra ones because of HIPAA. So we've got to make sure from a data security standpoint and an access standpoint that's buttoned down pretty tight, both from an internal and especially an external standpoint. So, there are other things. And the other one that Mary and I talked about a little bit earlier is the amount of data, mm-hmm. That we have to save, have online, whether it be, and it's funny because sometimes they'll say, well, I need that 10 years worth of that data. And you try to find out, well, whose rule is that? is that a self-imposed rule for the department? Is it one for the company? Is it NCQA told us? Is it the division of insurance? And finding that out sometimes takes a while, because otherwise, how do you have some sort of ILM strategy or anything to move data from one spot to another unless you really understand those? Because if NCQA comes in and asks a question and they audit something and the rule is you need to provide it within 12 hours, that's different than providing it within 48 hours, okay, or 4 days. So you need to understand all of those so that your data is in the appropriate place, can get access from a governance perspective as well as your own company. And then you can put some data plans in place. Then you have the security layered on top of it, only people accessing data that it's a need-to-know type basis. So, data is a huge issue from both a storage standpoint and a security standpoint.
Yep. Now, I've been kind of hogging the panel's attention up here. I don't want to make you think you have to sit there silent the whole time. If anyone has questions, please wander up to the microphone, and I'll let you wrest the panel's attention away from me if you like. But otherwise, I will continue. John, I wanted to bounce back down to you again about we talked about a major challenge that you see in the future, about a lot more data from these sensors, about all the things that RFID is going to pick up, but that there's a lot of data even now that no one is able to leverage. Where do you see this problem, or is this one of those theoretical exercises?
No, I mean, it's a real problem. Actually, I hesitate to speak because in the audience I noticed there's, we have Paul Hoffman from SAP, and they have a lot of data. But I've heard comments from companies that a lot of the data that's collected, you know, is not used.
That's right.
Now, we're going to be tagging, you know, products in the supply chain. There's probably several billion products out there that could be tagged, and we're going to be getting a lot of low-level data that really we've got to understand the meaning of that data to get a return on the investment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're looking at how do we turn this low-level data into data that is useful, that has meaning. We're looking at machine learning capabilities to do that because you're going to have to process this data in real time. Mm-hmm. And probably you want to only push some of the data up, you know, leave most of it where it is. It's useless. I was just going to mention, we talking about sensors. We had some students and they deployed some sensors in MIT in Building 9. And the sensors are still running and we can see the data, but we don't know where the sensors are. The students left. They're up in a ceiling somewhere. So it's just useless data.
Well, this is probably going to useless data. Now there's an oxymoron, huh? We're probably going to end up with the IT version of the tree falling in a forest and does it make a noise if no one hears it. Is data really data if no one pays any attention to it or does anything with it? I suppose, Rich, you're nodding. You want to add something?
Well, you know, I just think that's a huge problem. You know, who really cares? You know, you have an ID tag on something like this. After it's delivered to its end user, who really cares about it, right? And why wouldn't you throw that away? But we're a society that doesn't like to throw things away because of governance and, you know, policies and so on. And I think that's going to become a real problem is how do you really decipher which data? I was at a large insurance company, and they keep on upgrading their storage system. And they did an analysis. They have data from 1986 that they keep on migrating from storage system to storage system. Mm-hmm. They have no clue what the data is. They have no clue whether it's good or not. But they continue to migrate it because they're just so afraid of throwing it away.
See, I think we've all got boxes like that in our attic that we've moved six times with us, but we have no idea what's in the box anymore.
You know, the other issue, too, of all of the data has ended up on someone's desktop in some MDB file. So, you know, there's thousands of those in people's environments that you don't know if they're using the right data at any one particular time, whether it's correct or whether how up to date it is. I mean, so you have that you almost can't control because you don't see it.
Right, right. Well, actually, then maybe those two guys that are running your governance stuff, maybe they know where it is.
I did just want to make one comment that there is use in tagging things that you may want to know that, you know, if this was a drug, you might want to know that it's the real thing. There's a lot of counterfeiting going on, and it's not just expensive goods like, you know, Rolex watches.
Right.
It's of things like Coke, of Duracell batteries, even water.
Okay, good. In fact, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the supply chain and the effect of all the changes that are going on in infrastructure and how that plays. But we have a question from our audience.
I just want to find out what happened to RFID. For a while it was so hot, everybody was looking at it. Looking at everybody's industry, including medical, you could just see so many uses, tagging patients. You can, you know, the uses go on, and yet you read very little about real-life case studies where RFID has really taken hold.
Oh, I mean, it depends what area that you're looking at. RFID, now if you go into your car park, you're probably using an RFID tag in the cart. Passports have got RFID tags in them. The price is going down in the supply chain. You know, they haven't taken off where there's billions yet, but infrastructures take a while to deploy. You know, barcodes took 20 years.
Is there any major impediment now?
Cost. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, cost. You've got to.
Prices come down tremendously.
Sure, but I mean, you have to have infrastructure to read these. It's, you know, within four walls, they can be used, and they are being used there. Where it's tough is across, you know, when your products start in China, we have to get China to agree to standards. Without standards, it's not going to work. You know, we've made great progress, and it looks like China now will, you know, adhere to the standards that are being developed. But that's the problem with supply chains, to some extent, are the toughest problem because they're across enterprises, across countries. It's not so easy to get the standards agreed to. But it's happening. There's been great progress, and I just think it's early days.
And sometimes just the way media works, which is one thing I can speak directly to, a lot of times when something becomes very mainstream and accepted, right, there's no story anymore. I remember a couple of years ago somebody asked me, whatever happened to Java? Didn't something happen with it? And I said, well, Java's actually in a whole lot of places and everywhere. Well, we never see Computer World write about it anymore. And it was just that when things become very mainstream, and of course with retailers are all very familiar with all the RFID issues. In fact, I don't think I've ever heard anything but complaints on that end. But that was because Walmart said you will have it done by this particular date. So it hasn't yet, no. But it must be.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it is happening that you'll see RFID everywhere. The Nokia just got RFID readers in the cell phones. Near-field communications, which is an example of RFID, you know, in the passports they're putting RFID tags.
Slower than it would have seemed
with
the hype of 3 or 4 years ago.
I remember once.
I don't know. If you think it's slower, I don't know what your trajectory was.
Well, Bill Gates once said that most technologies that people predict will be with us in 2 years generally take 10. Mm-hmm. And I think that was actually a pretty accurate assessment. Yes, a question over here.
Hi, my name is Joanna Fueo. I'm from IBM Healthcare and Life Sciences. And I had a question for the panel and really a comment about making sense of some of the lower level technology. Did you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Great. So you mentioned the need to make sense of this lower level data. And we have some new technologies that are really a combination of machine learning, natural language processing, text analytics that are helping to do this. So my question is, which areas would you like to start with? Would you like to start with data across the enterprise, looking at, say, trends in patient reactions to drugs? Would you like to look at best practices? And secondly, we have some new technologies that are geared towards what we're calling multimodal informatics, which combines an analysis of some of the higher level healthcare data, such as, for instance, images in neurology that depict therapeutic response to different drugs and derive attributes from those images to try to understand, you know, how a patient is responding to the drug and combine that with the clinical data. And so we're designing analytics that go through that data and actually help to understand better the therapeutic response as well as disease etiology. So my question is, you know, where to start across the enterprise when you have such a rich repository of data? And what are the most important and pressing questions to you?
Okay.
I start in finance. You only need to be a little better there. You don't have to be twice as good, just a little better. Finance is where I'd start now. I mean, people are applying it there. It's not like it hasn't been applied. They're applying it. Believe me, machine learning's been applied. Just go down to New York.
Mary, Frank, how about in healthcare organizations?
I think anything from that could take that data and help turn it into some sort of decision support system for docs and physicians. With all the changes in drugs and technologies and treatments and so on, you know, anything that could help reduce trend and spend from a healthcare perspective and improve workflow, I think, is the other thing. You know, in a doctor's workflow, I mean, they have to see so many patients on a day-to-day basis with so many different combinations of what may or may not happen from a treatment standpoint. Anything that could take all of that data, analyze it, and help transform it somehow magically into some decision support set of, not one, but into some decision support systems, I think would be very beneficial.
Okay, let's take our question over here.
Hi, I'm Bill Barnett with Wachovia Bank. I wanted to pick up on a comment that several of you made about the various levels of infrastructure getting more agile, and it feels to me like we're adding, that the default answer is to add a lot of complexity in each layer to add to the resiliency and how easy it is to provision and how easy it is to recover from a problem. And each specialty gets so amazingly deep and hard to understand that you get in the situation where the server guy hates the storage guy because they're always screwing each other up. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse, both in the distributed world and in the mainframe world. The more we do to make things resilient sometimes, the more we curse ourselves with nobody having the whole picture of how it works. So I'm interested in what you see as the counter trend, if there is one, of being able to understand the whole end-to-end down the stack so that you can identify and isolate problems when your auto magically stuff goes wrong.
Okay. Well, you know, I think for that to happen, one of the problems you do have is standards. You know, there are plenty of standards that exist out in the infrastructure world, storage standards and server standards. The problem is there's no real reason for the vendors to adopt those standards and push them, and that makes it difficult. So customers, you know, there has to be a customer reason for these vendors to adopt those standards and stop pushing them. I think this is exactly the point, though, is if those standards were adopted, common languages were set, and I think some of the tools I talked about, you know, some of the Web 2.0 tools will really help that. If you can get now the server guy and the storage guy collaborating and talking on a daily basis about, hey, I made a turn of my knob up here, and it impacted you down there, you know, that dialogue would be very, very healthy. And it doesn't happen today because enterprises are always in firefighting mode. They're always being in a reactive mode. So how do we get enterprises beyond reactive mode and into a proactive mode? And I think that's what's really needed is you need to be ahead of the curve. You need the tools in place to give you a look, you know, a day, 2 days, a week, a month down the road, and really fight problems proactively, not reactively.
Also, to add to that, one of the challenges is that we are adding layers of technology and nothing is going away. So if we talk about RFID, we talk about wireless. So the number of moving parts and the ability to diagnose problems when you have a brownout or something breaks and having to go through the multiple layers of the technology stack to be able to pinpoint it. So companies like Acori and others that are really focusing in on being able to provide monitoring tools and diagnostic tools are going to be very critical because the amount of, and I'm sure Frank experienced as well, when you have any of those types of system issues, the amount of time and energy and resources that it put on it till you can fix it, I see is just continuing to grow.
And I think the other important piece of it comes back to the people part of it is that you need your architects talking to one another. I mean, I think that's why it's real important to have an enterprise architecture group that's not necessarily involved all the time in fighting fires and in the middle of problems. But, you know, as you put pieces together, somebody up there has got to say, this is one big piece, not just all these little ones. And I think as you look at something, you're going to add something to a layer. You've got to see what the other effect is and make sure that you understand that within your architecture. If not, you're going to run into those problems all of the time. And they have to talk to one another. And it becomes a culture, a mindset, a way you do things. And if the way is talking to one another, collaborating on those things, and having each weigh in on how does this affect my piece of the infrastructure, you'd be in a better position, I believe.
Okay, we have another question over here.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Daly. I'm from Next Web Technologies. I'd like to follow up on a point Professor Williams just made where you said start in finance. And it doesn't need to be a lot better, it just needs to be smaller, a little bit better, right? We all, or everyone here, is talking about SOA, and it was a big movement for the last 5 years. When you all went to your finance department to get, I have two questions. When you all went to your finance department to get funding for these SOA initiatives, I'm sure you had to make some sort of pitch as to, at the end of the day, it's going to improve our productivity and our ROI. My question to you is what are some examples of how your SOA movements in your organizations have actually started to benefit the end users like myself? How am I now being exposed to services that are making me more productive every day?
Okay, we need to find a real-world example on the panel.
I'll try that initially. The thing is you don't go in and sell SOA. That's like every vendor coming into me and try to sell me SOA. You don't sell it. It's an approach. It's something that you do. And you're not going, I don't think the end user is going to see it right off the bat. And again, I'll take an enrollment example, you know, that's kind of real time. We do enrollment in a couple of different ways, and we run into a situation, for example, healthcare reform tells us, oh, you have to do a new enrollment type within 6 months, and then we have another one where we have to do something with the HSA, and you just don't have time to do it in 6 months, so you put something together really quickly. But then you take a step back and say, okay, well, here's two new enrollment types that I need just this year alone. Next year I could have another one. So if you're the person in enrollment that's running enrollment, you'd like to see maybe one enrollment system that has different front ends to it that satisfies all of your needs.
So then the following year, when healthcare reform, something else happens and they say you have to do something else, you have a quicker time to market because you have this base enrollment service and all you have to worry about is the difference on some front end of the integration piece. That's where I think you start to see it. But I don't think it's something right away, especially the first one in. But I don't think you really can go in and sell, you know, give me funding to do S. It's like I said earlier, give me funding to create the Agile Enterprise. I think it's, you decide this is the approach you're going to take. There's buy-in from the IT organization. And yes, you have to get buy-in from the business. And they all become part of that governance process. But it takes a bit. It doesn't happen right away. In reality, it may have started with the words 5 or 6 years ago, but I don't see you seeing much of anything except for the last couple. Maybe someone else can, you know, jump in. But
yeah, I mean, I think again, all the supporting infrastructure took some time really to develop and to be ready for where we are.
Well, it's
today.
Also really hard to single out anything in technology and say, oh, that went quickly, or oh, that was simple, that was easy, that went great, that went just the way we thought it would. Because just my experience following technology just from a journalism perspective for years is that the reason there are so many stories and the reason there's so much that gets written about it is because of the complexities and the difficulties. And I still tend to, whenever anyone starts saying, well, this is going to simplify your operations, my eyes roll right back in my head. Because I just flat out don't believe it. John, you wanted to throw in here.
Well, no, the analogy I make is with the automobile industry that builds cars on platforms. And I think SOA is like platforms, that we can deploy different applications on the same, you know, infrastructure.
That's a great
And it's I think that's the best analogy I've got. Mm-hmm.
Of course, as an end user, though, too, it might be invisible to you. You know, how do you know that company didn't adopt some SOA architecture and deliver a service to you more efficiently? You know, they're using less power, less cooling, less less response time. It's something that is probably happening. You know, not even realizing it today.
I suspect that we've also all seen a lot more of the user-friendly abilities when we've gone online. I think there's a lot of SOA probably lurking behind web portals, behind some of the things that, you know, everyone admires so much about Amazon and doing business in different areas. God, this is great. We've got tons of people. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. Beth Cohen from Broadleaf Services. I'd like to bring the Agile and the discussions earlier about SOA together, which is that there's been a lot of outsourcing in the last few years, and of course outsourcers tend to be verticals. You know, you that's why you pick outsourcers, because they're experts in one area or another. And I'd like the panel to address how you deal with the dichotomy of having, you know, somebody who's very good at, let's say, managing security services, yet as an enterprise you need something that's horizontal, and who's going to govern the management of those different vertical pieces and get them all speaking together.
Governance does keep rearing its ugly head, doesn't it? So would anybody like to take that? Going once, going twice?
We deal with we do a lot of outsourcing with the ES. I'm giving you my opinion here. This is Frank's opinion on this one. I think from an SOA standpoint, I really think you need to consider keeping your core services internal, because to me, that you need the domain knowledge within the company, because your company is different than somebody else's. So I think core services should really be kind of taken care of internally in the company, and you maintain those.
So what would you what would your definition of core services be in that case?
I'll go back to the enrollment piece. If I had a core enrollment service or any of the services that I build within my portals, okay, those services, if we've had outsourced developers come in, and it's very difficult for those developers the first time around to develop within our environment. So if I'm writing services within my environment, I probably want to keep those developers in-house, because they understand my infrastructure, my architecture in the pieces, how all of this has been done on a historical basis, so they need the domain knowledge. Something that isn't domain and more of a commodity, like a front-end something that is more
I guess less within the internal bowels of my systems, I think is something to outsource. But I think when it's core to your system, when it's core to your business, and you need domain knowledge to understand it, I think that's what you keep inside.
Well, and Alex, you could probably add to this, because data centers used to be considered pretty core to people's businesses, and now a lot of them are outsourced, especially mid-sized, smaller and mid-sized growing companies don't want to build their own anymore.
Much to Frank's point there, I mean, the things that we see the successful organizations do is they keep those things that are core internal to the business. When we're working with the business, we're more looking not vertical now, but horizontal, looking at either the facilities or the hardware or the operating systems, so that we're taking the horizontal approach as opposed to the vertical approach, really trying to push back to the organizations that we work with that the core business elements they need to take care of, because they're going to be the ones that can understand and adapt to it the best to be agile, whereas we're going to be able to take care of some of the more mundane pieces of the architecture in those horizontal layers that they maybe don't need to concern themselves with anymore.
It also might be fair to add that some companies change what is core to them over time as business changes. I remember when everybody was outsourcing their website development, because when companies first started having websites, it wasn't considered something that was going to be that important to their supply chain. And then there was a vogue for a while where everybody outsourced their help desks. And then they discovered that that made customer satisfaction go
down.
Well,
I was going to say managed security services. That's another thing that's been flipping back and forth, and actually is currently, IBM just bought internet security services, for example. So that's become now, just outsource it. So you're right. It changes over time.
We are creatures of fashion in the IT industry. Kind of like, what's the latest? Yes, this lady's been very patient.
Hello, Lynn Schmidt with Whitbread. Would you address how you manage the inventory of web services for reuse?
Manage the inventory of web services.
Right, because as you're building all of these web services and the idea of SOAs being able to reuse them, how do you let the folks in one area of the organization understand that those web services are available and to be reused?
Okay. Is there a standard approach? Is there a great way to do it? John?
No, I mean, one of the issues is, where do you do kind of roles? You don't want your web service, well, the problem will be, if you do your roles within web services, then the person that's using that web service has to have the same concept of roles. Now, we went through this and we decided not to do any roles in web services. They should be like slaves. They do anything that the person up here demands of them. But you need to have some kind of mixed decisions like that about how you architect them, how you make them reusable. Web services should have certain standard capabilities. You know, you should be able to kill them. You should be able to start them up, halt them, basic things like that that you need to be standard if you're going to manage them remotely. There aren't standards for them at the moment.
You know, we're developing libraries of our web services and starting to deal with those internal governance issues again of who can change and who has access and who's appropriate role for those services, but we're at the beginning step of that.
Yeah, I agree. It comes down, you need some sort of registry to maintain all of those services, but again, it comes back to governance. Not just the governance, but if you make it part of the SDLC process, where part of that process is going through and finding out, you know, we're creating this, do any of these services exist? Because over time, there's going to be so many. No one person's going to remember what's out there or not. But it should be, I think, baked into your SDLC services as well, process.
And that can also...
There were some companies, at least one company I know of in the industry that got acquired by Mercury, which got acquired by HP, was a company called SystemNet. And I believe they did a lot of that. Mm-hmm. They actually had the services registry. And I don't know what HP is doing with that technology these days, if they abandoned it or not.
And that's also oftentimes one of the signs of a maturing technology that's starting to get real traction in IT, where there will be a lot of products that start to come out, and then at some point, all of a sudden, someone is selling a framework or something that will help you manage those. Yeah. That often is like the sign that, you know, we're now the technology's in junior high school and the framework.
But you have the development piece with the registries, but then you have the service buses also from a runtime perspective. So, you know, you really need both pieces.
Okay. Sir?
My name is Kwaho Chen from Nortel. I'm hearing a lot of things about governance, and I'm looking at the world out there today where YouTube and all the younger folks in social networking and things, where governance is a no-no almost. They're almost against governance. And I think a lot of the world, a lot of the companies in here want these people, the public, to be their customers, at least today or going to the future. I wonder, from that kind of light, what does governance means for going toward the future?
I suspect it means governance needs to be invisible with this 20-something crowd. But because
what I'm hearing governance means is rules or access rights or privileges. Now, those privileges are being broken down by the young folks today. And we, as we aging, we have to say, how do we handle that? And it's going in collision course.
Okay. How do we trick them into being governed?
I was going to say, I mean, I think just in general, this whole topic of the changing workforce and what it does to how we operate, I think, is fascinating and one that haven't even started really to look at it. I think there was a time when the more sophisticated technology was in the workplace. Now it's more in the home and just how that's changing. But to the question about governance, for me, it really means around who decides. Who's making the decisions or prioritizing or deciding who gets access or who changes? And I think you're right in terms of the changing workforce. I had somebody new to our organization that thought that the entire IT organization should weigh in on every purchase decision. And you know, the reality of that, I think, is a little challenging.
Did they set up a wiki to do that? Well, I actually thought, Rich, your idea was a pretty good one, that you were recommending that most organizations should start playing with these technologies internally, literally playing, putting social media technologies in the hands of the company and see what happens.
Right,
absolutely. And I also wanted to follow up on what you said about that. Has anything changed in your business because of this? You said you've noticed that your 20-somethings IM each other, and they don't do as many as the face-to-face meetings, and that they're collaborating and doing more. Has it led to anything, except a lot of visits to Starbucks? Or, you know?
No, it has. It's definitely increased communication and collaboration. You see a lot quicker decision-making process is what's come out of it. We see architectural decisions, for example, taking days or half days instead of weeks.
Oh, all right, okay. Sir, question from you.
I have a two-part question. The first part is, on the business side, in the organizations that you guys are in, what are the businesses asking for that you can't provide them today? And part two, what's stopping you from providing those things?
Okay. Well, that's a nice big wide fireball for the panel.
I always hate to say it's something I can't provide. I think the two areas of challenge is around lowering the IT cost, and the second is how to do things faster.
Well, someone told me that, I didn't see Charlie Feld's talk this morning, but someone said that his basic message at the end was everyone's always trying to lower IT costs, and he said, IT costs money, get over it, was kind of one of the messages, and I'm sure I'm mangling whatever it was, but is that realistic? I mean, let's hear from you.
If I said to my CFO, get over it,
well, yeah. I'm wondering if, I don't know if Charlie said that to the CEO of EDS, you know?
Talk about career ending.
So what's stopping you from doing that?
A couple of things. One is that, I think as Frank said it earlier, that the fact that we sometimes are limited in terms of standards, and I'm not talking about technical standards, I'm talking about business standards, in terms of being able to say that not everybody can develop their own system. That there are lines drawn in the sand that everybody's going to use the same type of system or the same technology when you're in an environment where you've got that level of heterogeneity across systems. There's an expense and a complication that comes along with that.
And I think we all want everything faster, cheaper. It doesn't not just IT. I mean, it's everything else. And I think one thing that may help, and again, I think Charlie said this today, but the one thing I think that we've started to do a little differently is do things in pieces. Because a lot of times you sit back and you try to build the whole thing. You try to define and build the whole thing, and it takes a lot longer because it's not the first 80%. that you're trying to figure out. It's the last 20, right? It's the last 20 or the last 25, because that takes the longest and is the most expensive. So sometimes, I mean, starting with that first 80 or 75% or whatever it is, you at least get something quicker, I think, and then build upon it on in an iterative basis. That's just, you know, one way, I think, of looking at it. But, you know, everything is so complicated today and involves so much, and you're doing more pieces and there's more integration. You know, if anyone could build, you know, a better light bulb type of thing and make it faster, I think, you know, there's a lot of money there, and I'll work. Yeah.
Well, there's also a flip side to it where the demand for reducing IT costs never comes along with a concomitant reduction in the capacity and the demands on IT.
Absolutely.
It's always do everything. And I keep hearing people, especially IT executives, will tell you it faster, better, cheaper. You can pick two, you know, but you can't have all three when it comes to your IT organization. And if none of the demands were going up, then probably we'd all be, well, we'd all
well the
be
other thing that Mary brought up earlier, too, is what are we taking out?
That's right.
You know, we're putting everything in and replacing legacy pieces, but what are we taking out? You know, that helps with the cost perspective, too.
Well, and the pressures around keeping up with regulatory requirements has increased. Keeping up with security, huge for our, all of our environments.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, you had a very interesting observation when we were talking. You said you wouldn't believe how many companies really aren't doing what they should on HIPAA. That, you know, or who would fill in your regulatory compliance thing. You actually have customers who come to you and you find that they're kind of wide open and they're taking a big risk.
Yes. So many of the smaller industries that are actually, you know, have regulations to live up to are coming to us and saying, hey, we don't know how to get there, and are looking for practical advice on how to do it because their IT budgets are staying standard or staying, you know, 5 or 6% increases year over year, and they've got to go through and do these huge hurdles as it relates to, you know, regulatory bodies. And a lot of them are skipping them for now and trying to get through with what they can. So, you know, it's important to kind of, you know, to Frank's point, too, is to pick your battles on a lot of things, not just on the SOA architectures, but as well, you know, do what you think is going to make right and do what's going to give the most bang for the buck in terms of benefit.
Mm-hmm. And we will take one final question from our audience.
I appreciate it. My name is Jeff Scherer. I'm with InstaNote. Modeling and simulation, in order to get to that, hopefully it won't become an empty phrase or a cliche, the agile enterprise. How does one go about creating a best practice in modeling and simulation in order to incorporate the best of what is out there to achieving, you know, those primary objectives that we've been listening to this afternoon?
This might be a good place to say attending conferences like this one. But, John, let me throw that down to you.
I mean, I think what's happened over the last 10 years is security has become so serious now that, you know, you have to think of that from the start. I mean, some of the things that, you know, we're thinking about now where we're building fairly large-scale infrastructures is that security, caching strategies, how you're going to cache things. You know, you've got data that lives different times. You need to understand how you're going to deal with that different data, how you're going to shoot the cache down. I think that you have to think these days about, if you're going to scale, doing things in-memory databases. Again, you could call that a version of caching. But I think that those are the kinds of things that and how you're going to change. You know, you're not building a product that's static anymore. You're building applications that you know are going to change. And so having a strategy for, you know, a trajectory for change. And I think then understanding what the big guys are doing. What's IBM rolling out? What are Microsoft rolling out? You know, you have to understand where they're going. Because you're probably going to be building on one of those platforms.
And besides change, too, I think it's also allowing a level of customization. You know, every business is different. And I think too many people, vendors, try to shoehorn a common solution into a particular business without the customization that's required. So with best practices, how do you come up with products that you can customize as the customer?
Yeah.
Okay, and as my last two official acts, one, I'm going to ask Jeff to join me up here. And two, we need a big round of applause for an amazing panel who answered all kinds of good questions. Thank you very much.
Let's make sure we thank Mary Friend as well for doing an excellent job.
You've been listening to a podcast from the 2007 MIT CIO Symposium. For more information on this symposium, please visit mitcio.com. For CDNet, I'm Dan Farber.